From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I am from Livermore.
I'm from East Oakland.
Oakland, near Lake Merritt.
Alameda, California.
I'm in the Excelsior neighborhood.
Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I grew up in Sonoma County.
Coming up, we'll meet some longtime residents of Golden Gate Park.
16 here is Betsy. 38 is Buttercup, and then the last one is Bambi.
Then we'll visit the park that used to be a military base.
Presidio is one of these interesting terms that you think it is just the name of a particular place. And then you realize it's the name of a kind of a place.
And we'll go to a park playground for dogs.
All the bars pretty much on Lower Haight are very, like, dog-friendly. Every time you go in there, you're almost tripping over a dog.
Barks and recreation today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. We're going to start today's show with a follow-up to one of our past stories. Last September, we aired a piece by Todd Oppenheimer on how hard it is for small business owners to get through the permitting process here in San Francisco.
Okay, here I have a long pink form, and it lists no fewer than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different city departments that need to approve my application.
Well, a few of you called in with recommendations for other business owners to talk to. Here's Ted Lowenberg.
Hi, my name is Ted Lowenberg. I think the next story in that series is how a city that professes to help and be supportive of small business has such a Byzantine and arcane and expensive process for people to get into business can, with a straight face, say that they, in fact, support small business. They are very successful in killing them.
Ted recommended that we talk with Juliette Priest, the owner of the ice cream bar in Coal Valley, about the purgatory she went through in order to get her business open. We sent KALW's Colin Peden to get her story.
My name's Juliette Priest, and I own the ice cream bar. Been open about 3 years now, almost 3 years. I opened in January of 2012. Our waffle cone is probably one of the best things we have. Like a waffle cone with butterscotch ice cream would, if I had to recommend one thing, that or probably our root beer float. It's a very small business. It's an ice cream store. It's a neighborhood business. It started with even signing a lease. I was negotiating the lease, but before I signed the lease, I wanted to find out what I could do in this space, what was allowed. I wanted to do food, obviously, and I took many trips to the planning department, talked to probably 6 different planners. I got 6 different answers or more. Finally had to hire a lawyer to even get that answer for me. So that held things up for months, even just negotiating the lease. I didn't want to sign a lease if I couldn't have a food business here. So. And then it went from there to a conditional use permit, to sitting on somebody's desk for 6 months. Yeah, just went on forever while I was paying rent. Once it finally got, I finally got the permit to go ahead with construction. I even had to have a permit to do anything. It sat here vacant. I couldn't do any remodeling, couldn't do anything at all. And then when I could finally do that, it was a rush to get construction done. And even during that time, every turn, everything I tried to do, there was a permit, a problem, an additional fee. It couldn't get answers, or they changed the rules as you go. So it was pretty frustrating. I could have gone out and gotten a full-time job for a year and a half instead of, you know, waiting. It was always like, well, next week, it couldn't possibly take this long. You know, once I even had the Planning Commission's approval to open, they approved my conditional use. And then this was in January, and I thought I would get my building permit. It took until June or July to even start construction. So I lost an entire summer, lost all of that, you know, and then it didn't open until the next January. You know, I've gotten a lot of positive response. There are people who came in just because they, you know, to congratulate me for, you know, sticking with it and, you know, being able to open finally and not, you know, not giving up. But, you know, when you start into a small business, you don't have much choice. You keep waiting, and it's either you walk away with nothing, you know, and in debt, or you just keep borrowing money to, you know, and hope that you can open, which doesn't seem like the, you know, what it should take to open a business.
That was Juliette Priest, owner of the ice cream bar in Coal Valley, telling her story to KALW's Colin Peden. After visiting the ice cream bar, now let's walk a block up the hill and catch the N Judah train towards downtown San Francisco. Just after the tunnel under Buena Vista, we end up at one of the most iconic San Francisco parks, not because it's huge or historic, but because of who it serves. Reporter Louise Codd visited DuBose Park in the center of San Francisco to find out why the space has gone to the dogs.
It's a Tuesday afternoon, and as I'm getting off the N Judah train, I am greeted with a quite unusual sight for a modern city. Dogs are running wild all over the place. There is barking, balls are being thrown everywhere, and people of all ages are sitting around enjoying the spectacle. DuBose Park stretches out like a green cushion in a densely populated part of San Francisco. I'm meeting up with a guy from the city's park and rec department, and I find him standing at the corner of the park, looking out over the grassy field.
My name is Ashley David Weatherford. My friends call me Bean.
What strikes you the most about DuBose Park?
Certainly the lower half of the park is definitely dominated by dogs, and there's always a bunch of dogs in this park, and riding my skateboard through and stuff, they usually like to chase after me on it and whatnot.
DuBose Park was founded in 1902. When the park was first built, there were no designated dog areas. DuBose Park became the dog's park when dog owners defied the city leash laws by letting their canines run wild. And the city's park and rec department then saw the necessity of dedicating an official off-leash area for dogs. Today, the off-leash area of the park is actually larger than the on-leash area.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of dog owners are in this area of Lower Haight. And I know a bunch, like all the bars pretty much in Lower Haight are very like dog-friendly as well. And like every time you go in there, you're almost tripping over a dog. And which, you know, you don't really see a lot in, like, other cities in the United States. You don't really see that all that much, like dogs in bars. And, you know, it's just a different attitude towards dogs here. And I don't know, it just, it says something for about San Francisco, their love for these animals. I think it's great. And, you know, some people might say that they're kind of destroying the park. I mean, you can see some areas are brown, and I know that causes, you know, some controversy a little bit. Sometimes dogs do, but it's good that the dogs have their spot.
There are nearly 60 off-leash areas for dogs around San Francisco. But most of these parks and beaches are located on the outskirts of town. Now, though, the Golden Gate National Recreation Area is reducing off-leash areas by up to 90%. If you put this in contrast to the fact that 50% of San Francisco homes have dogs, it is easy to see why DuBose Park has become such a popular site for dog walkers.
Whether or not they gave the dogs too much space, I mean, that's just up for personal opinion. But
what's your opinion?
I think it's good the amount they give. I mean, you see back up this way, there's like, you know, a good amount of area, so I think it's good.
The dogs certainly do. In San Francisco's DuBose Park, I'm Louise Codd for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. DuBose Park might be the home of the dogs, but in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, a different kind of animal roams. Herds of bison. For over 100 years, the park has been home to these 900-pound symbols of Americana, which were originally brought in as part of a nationwide conservation effort. Through the years, the Golden Gate herds have bred more bison, drawn tourists, and been the pawns of high school pranks. The grazing animals are a park staple, but why are they still here? In this piece from our archives, KALW's Laura Cliven sifts through some hay at the bison paddock for answers.
16 here is Betsy, 38 is Buttercup, and then the last one is Bambi.
That's Sarah King, and she could be listing off a series of Disney characters, but she's actually introducing me to a herd of 8 furry bison in Golden Gate Park.
I'm a hoofstock person, so I like the big hooved animals.
King is employed by the San Francisco Zoo to be the primary bison keeper here. She works with fellow hoofstock fan, Jim Nappy.
I'm Jim Nappy. I'm curator of hoofstock and marsupials at San Francisco Zoo. We love bison.
We do.
They are kind of like your children. You know, you take care of them, and there's a lot of pride in that.
They might look friendly, but these bison are definitely not docile.
I think people write these guys off like they're just a bunch of cows, and we have to remember they're not domestic. They're still wild. They act wild. These animals are extremely stubborn and very smart.
So they're not your average cow, and they're not your average buffalo either, although the words are often used interchangeably.
The buffalo was food, clothing, shelter, sport, trade goods, and every utensil.
Buffalo live in Africa and Asia, but bison are native to North America. They also have smaller horns and bigger humps and faces than buffalo. And
their fur is so dense that snow can actually settle on top of it and not melt. So that's why they are perfect for the Great Plains area.
So what are they doing in the moderate climate of San Francisco? Nappy says the bison were brought to Golden Gate Park back in 1892. But to understand why, you have to go back even further.
From Pennsylvania to the Rocky, and from the Great Slave Lake to the Rio Grande, the herds were growing when the Spaniards saw them in 1521. 60 million and growing. It was the new world.
There were so many bison that when Lewis and Clark crossed the U.S. in the early 1800s, they wrote that, quote, "the moving multitude darkened the whole plains." For the Native Americans, bison were central to their livelihoods. But then the U.S. frontier moved west. Bison numbers started dropping dramatically from overhunting and disease. Businesses advertised bison hunting competitions, and settlers intentionally killed bison to limit Native American resources.
And soon the railroads came. They brought gentlemen hunters who slew for so-called sport. They brought hunters who killed for tongues alone. And they brought hide hunters with their skinners. The prairies began to rot with wasted carcasses.
You know, when there's 30 million of one type of animal and within, you know, a 100-year period, there's only several thousand, there's a problem.
By the late 1800s, the number of bison bottomed out at about 1,000. It was then that independent organizations began placing small herds in zoos and private farms across the country.
San Francisco was an area that was identified as a place that could house bison. And that's what they did. At that time, they just offered big fields, big pastures, and they just threw a lot of animals in there and said, let's just let these guys breed. Let's improve, you know, their numbers, get the population up to help with the conservation effort.
Efforts like this, plus a commercial boom for bison meat, slowly brought numbers back up to about 500,000 today. Most of these bison live in captivity, except for a large, free-roaming herd in Yellowstone National Park. Jim Nappy says the San Francisco bison contributed directly to the conservation movement. Overall, 100 calves were born in the bison paddock as people lined John F. Kennedy Drive to watch.
And each spring, new herds rumbled out of a legendary cavern and covered the land with abundance.
Today, the bison in Golden Gate Park are no longer breeding. But don't worry, they'll be around for a while. 6 of the all-female herd were brought in as calves in 2011, and the other 2 are in their 20s, while the herd's matriarch just died at age 30. Over the years, These bison have come to mean many different things to San Franciscans, like the high schoolers who would let them out as their senior prank, or the Native Americans who held their ceremonies here. But for those who know their story, they are a reminder of this city's role in preserving a character from our past.
They're part of the history of that effort and those efforts that we continue with other animal species, and I think the park represents that with bison. It's a good story.
For Cross Currents, I'm Laura Clivens.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Even with all the park space, San Francisco is still America's second most densely populated area after Manhattan. Yet there are parts of the city so lightly populated that, well, you could shoot off a cannon and not hit anybody. Like, for example, during last year's ceremonial reopening at the Officers Club at the historic Presidio. It's not that the 1,500 acres of the Presidio are vacant. About 4,000 people work there, around 3,000 live there, and tens of thousands visit every week. The Presidio has been part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area since 1994, but its history goes deeper than that, as KALW's Stephen Short tells us in this installment of The Source.
Our story begins in 1776. Not that 1776. This 1776. This was the year that Spanish colonists arrived, by way of Mexico, to establish the Presidio at the mouth of what would become known as San Francisco Bay. When military operations move into an area today, it's usually by the thousands, with specialists ranging from cooks and medics to helicopter pilots and ground troops. That, says Eric Blind, is not the way it happened here.
This is only a couple hundred, Spanish colonists, about 35 soldiers and their rather large families. Uh-huh. A lot of kids here.
Eric Blind has worked at the Presidio since 1997.
And I'm the director of heritage programs and sites here for the Presidio Trust.
Blind says that if you had stumbled upon this colony, it would have looked less like an invading army and more like some sort of summer camp.
More than half the population here at the Presidio is under the age of 15, even on the long journey up from Mexico, hundreds of miles. And most of the colonists are children.
Blind says this group was far from the only human presence in the area. At this time, in the 1770s, there were hundreds of native villages encircling the bay.
San Francisco Bay Area is one of the most densely populated areas per square mile, per acre, in North America above Mexico. It is highly populated and is highly diverse. Five different languages spoken here, and the native people here had a very similar kind of a cosmopolitan, multilingual landscape that in some respects we do now.
Well, let's start with the adobe walls.
It's an old colonial chapel that the Spanish built. But every fall, we would bury it back so it would be protected for the winter rains.
So now you have built replicas of these walls, right? So that people can look at them and touch them. And these reproductions are maybe thigh high, waist high, depending on how tall you are. And then in front of them, Eric, this looks like a pile of rocks.
Well, that's part of the interpretive landscape on top, because you really have to have an archaeological eye and to appreciate the pattern to this this pile of rocks and actually how it creates the base of large walls, which would have housed this chapel, one of the first ones here in the Bay Area.
Lacking an archaeological eye, I decided to ask the question that brought me here in the first place. Tell me what Presidio means.
Oh, Presidio is one of these interesting terms that you think it is just the name of a particular place. And then you realize it's the name of a kind of a place.
He says this is only one in a line of presidios extending from San Francisco
all through the southwest of the United States, across Texas, into the deep south, and across Florida. And it was what the Spanish Empire used at their borders to extend and defend their borders. And presidios go way back. It comes from the Latin root word, presidi, which basically means preside.
A presidio, unlike a fort, was more than a military installation.
You know, it's the beginning of a colonial population that hopefully would expand your empire that way, through kids.
Cannons were never really needed in this remote location. In fact, Blind says, it has often been said that a shot was never fired in anger from this presidio.
Which technically is true, but it's true because the Spanish, the Mexican, and the U.S. Army obeyed what I consider to be kind of the first rule of any kind of military engagement, which is always fight on the other guy's land.
As in, take the battle to them. Cannons may not have been fired in anger here, but they were fired regularly. The purpose was twofold.
Every day, for probably well over a century, and it ended in 1994, the U.S. Army would play reveille at 5 o'clock, and they would fire off a couple of howitzers out here at the flagpole. And that was, depending on your kind of status, it was either the end of your workday or it was the beginning of happy hour. Many of the soldiers and officers said the 5 o'clock cannon was when you knew it was Miller time.
There was talk of reviving this custom, the firing of the cannons, not the 5 o'clock happy hour. That's why cannon fire was heard at the reopening of the officers' club.
And what we learned pretty quickly was there's been a couple of things that have changed between 1994 and now. And one of those is the advent of car alarms. And so when these cannons went off, the other thing that went off was hundreds of car alarms in the parking lot from all the people we had in attendance.
The people now living in and around this old military base have certainly benefited from the retirement of that tradition. Today, the skirmishes at the Presidio involve new development. One good thing about that is they don't require protection from cannons. In San Francisco's Presidio, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Now we'd love to hear from you. What part of San Francisco would you like Stephen Short to investigate? Email us at news@kalw.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter @KALW. Or better yet, call us. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Marlo McKenzie, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Sandhya Dirks. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by San Francisco band The Tropics. They'll be warming things up this Friday night at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.